Hey, it's episode 437 of the 343 Podcast. Today's episode is a critical one, very critical. It's all about having a vision. And let me tell you why it's critical. If you are coaching a team at any level whatsoever, it could be a national team, pro team, a youth team, doesn't matter. You have to have an ultimate objective, an ultimate vision of how you want your team to play. Because if you don't have that, you're flying blind, guys. It's kind of like you're the captain of a ship who has no target destination and has no compass to boot. So you need to have a vision. And secondly, what is a good vision? Because all visions are not created equal. Which visions are actually achievable? Which ones are unachievable? That and so much more in this episode. I hope you enjoy. Here we go. Speaking about getting good information for you as a coach or you as a parent, coaches, you need to go to 343coaching.com. There are free and premium programs for you there. How do you know whether this is a good program for you, yes or no? Well, we eat our own dog food. We have been coaches for multiple decades and have done pioneering and remarkable work here in the United States of America, from U9 up through graduating youth players to the college ranks to the professional ranks. And we also have worked in the professional ranks for the better part of a decade. So we've seen all the cycles, all the ages, just everything under the sun. So yeah, when it comes to who you should be learning from, I have no qualms about promoting our own stuff, which is, by the way, what sponsors this podcast. We don't accept any other sponsors. So coaches, do yourself the biggest favor of your entire careers and go to 343coaching.com. There are free programs and premium programs for you there. If you've known us for a long period of time, you know what we're about, you know the work that we have accomplished, you should hop on board the premium program. Don't even wait. Dive headfirst into it. And parents, the same goes for you. With all our experience, we've codified it and tailored a program just for you so you can better guide and mentor your kids. That is at 343masterclass.com. 343masterclass.com is where you want to go. And coaches who are coaching in the 7-versus-7 format, you should go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoy this critically important episode. Here we go.
One of the things that I like to do to get inspiration for our podcasts is to go through our archive of thousands of videos that you have recorded over the past two decades. And I want to start with, or I want to talk today about vision. So there's two different things, Gary, having vision and having a vision, right? And I'm going to let you explain the differences. But the reason why I bring this up and what I found is there's a video of you from the first summit that 343 did 12 years ago. And your opening talk is all about this topic, Gary, having vision and having a vision. So maybe at the end of the episode today, I can insert that and we can see how much is still aligned. I mean, I'm sure it's all the same, but just for the audience sake, I want them to see that you've been preaching the same stuff for decades. So let's start very simple, Gary. Can you explain for the audience, what is the difference between having a vision and having vision?
Yeah, having a vision, I think I'm going to talk about it in the context of the way you framed it, right? So having a vision, usually I would ascribe to a leader, i.e. like a coach or an entrepreneur or a business owner or somebody who is projecting forward into the future, meaning a week into the future, a month into the future, a year into the future, 10 years into the future, right? You have to have a vision for your ultimate objective. So in the context of football, if we put our coaching hats on, an example of having a vision is how do you want your team to play? And so since it was World Cup time all of last month and it just ended a handful of days ago, everybody kind of understands how Spain plays, and everybody kind of understands how maybe Argentina plays. Probably not, but they have an idea of what that kind of looks like, right? Whether it be correct or incorrect. So if we stick with the Spain one, because everybody's buzzing about Spain, the vision associated with that is, hey, let's have possession of the football. Let's not cough it up too easily. Let the other team have 20% possession or 30% or 40%, but not more than that. We have to be owners of the ball. And how are we going to do that? And what sectors of the field? And then how are we going to end up scoring, having possession of the football? So that is having a vision, Benny. And once you have a vision, now you can start working backwards and say, how do I make that a reality? How do I train my team so that that ends up being our end product? And what types of players and player profiles do I need in order to maximize the probability that that ultimate vision is going to come to fruition? Because if that's what I want, then clearly I do not want midfielders who aren't very technical and cough the ball up too easily. Yeah, you're looking for the maximum technique and maximum soccer IQ for, in this example, your midfielder. In other words, you can't have, at the highest of all levels in the world, you cannot have a Weston McKennie being your central midfield player profile. So that's having a vision, Ben. I'll pause there. Maybe you can dig a little bit deeper.
Yeah, we might have to reserve having vision for the end of the episode or a completely different episode because there's so much to talk about when it comes to having a vision. So let's start with, and I know we talked about this before, but I know there's always new audience coming in, so it's okay to bring it up again. How did yourself and Brian come up with your own vision of how you want your teams to play?
We're from Argentina, Argentine heritage. I mean, we were both born in the United States and raised in the United States, but our parents are from Argentina. All our extended family, aunts, uncles, grandparents, cousins, everybody is from Argentina. And obviously our parents emigrated over here when they were young. They had us, and naturally our first language in the household was Spanish, and we were brought up with the Argentine sort of culture in the household, even though when we left the household, our surrounding environment was not Argentine culture or Argentine heritage, but nonetheless, we have that. And so naturally, we had an inclination for watching Argentine football, whether it be Boca, River, Vélez Sarsfield, Independiente, Racing. I'm naming off all the clubs in the first division of Argentina. And of course, the Argentine national team. And so that was kind of our role model, not to mention that when we were little kids is when Argentina won the 1986 World Cup. And then after the 1986 World Cup, they were runners up in the 1990 World Cup. So imagine that is a world powerhouse is Argentine football. And so if you want to learn from the best, you got to pick the best. And since our culture is from Argentina and not Germany, right? Because we beat Germany in 1986 and we lost to Germany in the 1990 final. So we're not going to pick Germany. We're going to pick Argentina. So we look at Argentina. And what does Argentina do? They like possession. They want to hold on to the ball and maximize that. Not to necessarily to the degree that Pep Guardiola's Barcelona did it, because that was three standard deviations beyond what everybody had ever seen. And same with the Spanish national team when they won their first World Cup with Andrés Iniesta, Busquets, Xavi. That was such a high insanity level of possession that the world had never seen. And this Spain is very similar, today's Spain, the current world champion. But nonetheless, Argentina values possession very much so. So that is our starting point, Benny. We want the ball. We don't want to piss the ball away. And then you can start talking about coaches, right? Okay, who are the coaches to look at? Maybe Bilardo, 1986-1990. You also look at Marcelo Bielsa, who came onto the scene, you know, a decade after that, which brought a lot of quote-unquote verticality to Argentine football. Nowadays, Americans say the word verticality because they heard the word for the very first time, maybe, I don't know, 6 years ago. And they start talking about verticality. But imagine, we knew about verticality in the year 2000. So it's been 26 years that Brian and myself have been very aware and implemented verticality. Because actually, I think Bielsa may have even coined the term. Don't hold me to it, but I'm pretty sure he coined the term verticalidad. Okay? And then it migrated over here over the course of time. So, Benny, we were looking at that, and then from the club level, I said Pep's Barcelona, and to mix in something else, which was incredible, was Real Madrid's counterattacks during that era also. And we're like, wow, that's incredible. Barcelona can't do those counterattacks. Argentina can't do those counterattacks, but Real Madrid kind of was the master of lightning bolt counterattacks, which were absolutely devastating to the opponent. So Brian and I were like, well, we want some of that too, you know? And then when Marcelo Bielsa took over Chile, he made that team not only vertical, but outrageous in counter-pressing. Way before the Americans were talking about counter-pressing. Way before they heard from the Germans and Jurgen Klopp, gegenpress. Way before then, okay? We saw Bielsa doing it with Chile. And actually Argentina before that to a certain degree. So Brian and I are like, well, we want some of that in our teams too. So we wanted the possession, we wanted the counterattack, and we wanted the counter-pressing. So that formulated the most important broad brushes for the vision.
So a lot of people will say, oh, so you're just copying Barcelona and you're copying Real Madrid and you're copying Marcelo Bielsa. Is there anything wrong with copying, Gary? Especially
absolutely
if you're
not
your coach, right? How are you expected to just know everything? You should be looking up to role models and you should be copying and pasting, basically, yeah? But a lot of people have a problem with that, especially in academics, Gary, because people are going to say, oh, you shouldn't copy and paste. You should do your own work, right? Yeah. So riff on that a little bit, Gary. Is there any problem with copying?
It's the exact opposite, Ben. We should be copying. You said it already. If you're a new coach, you should be maximizing the amount of copying that you do. New coach is a relative term, because I say that and people think, oh, it's your first season ever coaching. Well, from my vantage point, I'm thinking if you've been coaching 5 years, you're a new coach. You know, so as the years go by, you should be copying and copying and copying and copying and copying. I literally just said, and you pointed out, I wanted to copy Pep's Barcelona, Marcelo Bielsa's counter-pressing, you know, and incredible intensity and no plays off. And I want to copy Real Madrid's counter-attack. How do we do those things? Let's see who's done them and let's try to mimic them. And when you do that, you're learning a lot of valuable lessons. You're learning how to train the team. You're learning how to train the players. You're seeing your own blind spots. And how do you know how to train teams and players? Yes or no? What are the issues? And you try to resolve them over and over again. The worst thing that a coach can do, especially when you're quote unquote new, and for me, it's under 10 years, you are new. And even people who are over 10 years, you are new. And even people who have 20 years of experience, they might have 20 years of experience in doing one particular thing over and over again. But now all of a sudden, if they want to do what Brian did, or they want to do what Klopp does, or they want to do what Pep does, they're brand new all over again. Even though you've been coaching 20 bloody years, you're brand new when you want to do something else. So everybody's new, always and forever, unless you get stuck in doing the same thing over and over and over again. And if you're a professional coach, you're also new. So yeah, what was your question, Minnie? Oh, what do I think about copying? You should be copying from people who have done remarkable work. And that opens up a whole other can of worms. What is remarkable work? Who's doing remarkable work? And it's not as easy as you think to discern who's who in this space.
Yeah, so obviously you guys came up with your vision 20 years ago. Do you think if you were to start today, that it would look a little bit different? Or like, who would you model your teams after today, do you think? Just so it's a little bit more updated for the audience, or maybe it's the same. No, we still want to play the same exact way that we have been playing.
Yeah, so there's something called first principles thinking, okay? And you want to reduce everything down to what are the fundamental building blocks of a complex system. So when you reduce everything down successfully and accurately, because that's a whole other question, are you doing it correctly or not? Are you identifying fundamental building blocks? Yes, or are they not fundamental? Once you think you've identified the fundamental building blocks, those are the fundamental building blocks. You don't change from the fundamental building blocks. Makes no sense whatsoever. It's kind of like, well, if you were to do it all over again, would you learn addition and subtraction and multiplication and division, you know, when you're starting out in mathematics or something? It's like, well, those are kind of pretty foundational, you know, like how do you say, nah, let's not look at those things at all. Let's go straight to something else. Well, you look at that something else, you're like, well, how you can't even comprehend it because you don't have the foundation. So possession is a fundamental building block. Do you know how to keep a soccer ball? Do you want to keep a soccer ball? If the answer is no, you don't want the ball, then you can't win. It's foundational to the game. Okay? So possession, maximizing possession, very fundamental. Counterattacking. Is counterattacking a great fundamental tool in an attempt to score a goal, which is foundational? Seems like a fundamental tool to use. Do I want to get rid of that from my toolkit and never think about counterattacking or minimizing that? No, I want to maximize my team's capability to counterattack. Why would I get rid of that? And then when we lose the ball, we already covered that you want it. How do you get it back? And what maximizes the probability that you'll get it back? It seems that counterpressing and making massive pressure is pretty foundational and fundamental. No pressure whatsoever, the other team keeps the ball. The other player keeps the ball. So you want to maximize pressure, don't you? So it seems like those three things are immutable, Ben. And I can hear some folks now already in my ear because I've heard all the objections. People need to understand, I have been you. I have had all those logical reasonings, rationalizations that you have. I understand them inside and out. And I can hear people, well, possession isn't the only way to win. Of course it's not. But if you have the capability to own the ball far greater than the opponent, that is probably what you want to do. And if you don't have that capability, well, guess what? Tool, how can you beat the opponent? With the other tool, the counterattack. Or when the other opponent has the ball and is in your territory, right? The closer they get into your goal, your final third, your defensive third, you're maximizing pressure there because there's more bodies. So there's the counterpressing piece. And yes, will we sacrifice possession intentionally, Ben, in games with our teams or whatever? Abso-fucking-lutely. If you run up against an opponent that is superior to you, that is a perfectly legitimate deployment to maximize the chances of you winning. You're like, okay, you have the ball, no problem. We're now going to just train in how are we going to get it? And when we get it, what do we do with it? So yeah, Ben, I wouldn't change anything. Are there little variations or tweaks here and there? Yes, because if you have a roster with different player profiles, you have to tweak some things. But the foundation doesn't change.
What teams today currently could somebody watch and say, this is similar to what the vision that you guys had back in the day? Because obviously it was Barcelona, right? Real Madrid, and then Chile. Obviously, yes. Teams, I mean, Barcelona still possesses. Real Madrid still counterattacks. Chile, not the same with their pressing after Bielsa left. But what teams today currently would you say, or maybe if you want to think on it and bring it in at the end of the episode, but I want people to be able to go out today and go watch a game of this team and say, hey, this is exactly what Gary's talking about.
Yeah, well, I think not much has changed, has it? Because once these teams have found their quote-unquote identities, they tend to stick with their identities, which is a great way to maximize the team and the player's posture and inclination and assimilation of information to fulfill the vision. So in this case, let's say Barcelona or Spain, everybody and their mom know this is how we play. So when you're a player that's going to join that team or a coach that is going to lead that team, you're already coming into a situation where you know the identity, you know the DNA, and you know how to incorporate it and how to align yourself with it. So you're asking me examples. Well, clearly Spain and Barcelona still have that possession identity, and they probably are the number one team. One might be able to say that Pep Guardiola's Manchester City would also be a role model for that, but Pep is gone. But I presume that, I forgot the gentleman's name who's coming in, it escapes me now, who has also always been a part of that circle. Man City is going to continue with that identity and DNA because Pep has kind of made it part of the culture at the club. Counterattacking, this is an interesting one. Because most of the best teams in the world, Ben, hold possession. So I wanted to say Real Madrid, and it could still be Real Madrid. I think that's probably still a good role model for counterattacking. But most of their games, they're going to have possession. And the reason I chose Real Madrid back in the day as an example of counterattacking is because that was during the era that when they played Barcelona, they did not have, Real Madrid did not have possession. And Mourinho and company, they're like, we always have possession, but now we're up against Barcelona. We're not, we cannot compete at that level. So we are going to go into a mid block or maybe even a low block at times. And then when we get it, we're going to go ape shit crazy with Bale, with Ronaldo, with Benzema, and just go bananas, lightning speed forward. I'm not sure of a team that does that currently in world football to that degree. So my recommendation would be, hey, try to find when a game is going to be lopsided, like a Barcelona versus, I don't know, Valencia or Barcelona versus Villarreal or something like this, where you know that Barca is going to have the ball. And I can guarantee you that the entire week leading up to that match, the inferior team has been training how to counterattack as fast as they can. And then counter-pressing, obviously, Barcelona again, because when they lose it, they want it back right away.
Yeah. Just when you were talking, I was thinking about PSG with Luis Enrique.
Yes.
They do all three of those things, right? They possess, their pressing is fucking insane, their counter-press is insane. Like, it's all kind of bundled up into literally the 3-4-3 vision and methodology.
Agreed. Yeah, you're right. But I don't know how that escaped me, because usually I don't think about French football. I don't know why.
So, Gary, let's help out young coaches here. Okay, so I want to give myself as an example. I grew up in this system. I grew up watching my older brother play with Brian's teams. I myself was on Brian's team. Okay, and so naturally, when I started coaching, obviously, what's my vision going to be? Well, I grew up in this whole system my whole life. So, yes, I'm going to play possession. And yes, we're going to look to press when we don't have the ball. But I'm putting myself in the shoes of another coach who didn't grow up in the system, didn't have a good mentor growing up. And I'm just wondering, like, how do they even, where do they even start to start trying to form a vision for how their team they want to play? Like, I'm trying to imagine what my vision would be if I didn't get exposed to you and Brian, and just how different it would be, man. Because what are we used to seeing here in American soccer, college soccer, is physical. Route one, fucking hit the ball up, compete in the air. How can a young coach really establish what it is that they want their team to do?
It's a great question, Ben. It's a great question. I'll run a mental exercise here and hypothesize, educated guess, right? Because I've obviously dealt with a lot of young coaches over the years, hundreds probably. They're consuming all kinds of information online. They're reading all kinds of articles. They're reading all kinds of tweets or X posts from different coaches or media outlets, and they're doing it on Instagram as well. So they're getting inundated with all kinds of angles and no real coherent methodology by anyone, really. So you're getting all being shot at from all kinds of angles. So I would imagine that there is a lot of confusion, but over the course of time, maybe naturally and organically, this young coach, some things will stick in their brains. And then it's kind of from all that chaos, something naturally emerges in their mind as to what they would like to see in their team. And I think that's a very weird way to converge on something, because you don't really know the reasons why you converged on it. So I'll tell you the ideal situation. The ideal situation, obviously, Benny, is from all that noise, somehow identifying somebody reputable, somebody who has done what they preach that they have, that they believe in, somebody who has done something remarkable and that isn't just in the noise, and then somebody who is a good teacher and a mentor and willing to be that teacher or mentor to you. And it doesn't have to be in person. Nowadays, a lot of it is digital. And it's not a mystery that a lot of our learning is digital in nature. And so, you know, where I'm going with this is this was the plight of many coaches in 2013 when they saw our teams playing both online and in person. And they wanted to know how it is that we did what we did. And that's why we developed the 3-4-3 program. So you go in there, you sign up, you get to see the master, my brother Brian, coaching the players, coaching the teams, and you get to see the teams in action. You get to see the whole methodology come to fruition. You get to see the exercises. You get to see the delivery of the message, et cetera, et cetera. Is there somebody else or something else like that in the world. There's plenty of programs and courses out there. Again, is it good? Is it not good? I don't know, because I don't join any of those sorts of things. The only thing I would say is do your homework. And by doing your homework, the most important piece is have these people who are offering this mentorship or program or course or whatever, have they actually done it themselves? Is there proof of them having done it themselves? What is good proof versus what is not good proof is another question altogether. I think you need to have an extensive video library showcasing your own teams and your own players doing what you've been preaching online and doing it to a remarkable level. And that's the third component. Is what they've done remarkable? Because you could be illustrating a team that is doing quote unquote possession, your team. You could be cutting some clips and showing your team pressing or counterattacking. You could do all these things, but the team might be operating at some recreational level, which is great work, by the way. Don't get me wrong. That's awesome if you're able to manage and do all this stuff at quote unquote the lower levels. Brilliant. Perfect. It's good for your coaching development that you execute it, and it's good for the kids' development that you execute it. However, are you a master at it? Because I think to illustrate a degree of mastery with this sort of methodology, you have to be also doing it or having done it at the cutting edge and advanced kind of what's been possible, been able to do it at the state of the art and advance the state of the art. That is the purest signal to me that, wow, this is something remarkable. And that is a sign of somebody who knows their stuff. So gosh, it sounds kind of like an infomercial for the 343 coaching program, but this is how I answer the question, Ben, because I try to take that same philosophy to areas where I have no expertise in, or minimal expertise, or mediocre expertise, and I want to learn more. Who do I learn from? If I want to know how to make beer in my garage, I'm sure there's a whole bunch of people out there with courses and programs and social media presence and stuff who talk about that or do that. But who do I learn from? How do I find a true quote unquote master? How do I know that somebody is the shit? I'm sure a whole bunch of people can brew beer in the garage, but there's a difference, you know? So that would be my advice for a young coach is, I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't know what you want to add to that.
Yeah, no, it's extremely difficult recognizing who is an expert and who is kind of just talking out of their ass, right? And unless you have years and years of experience, you're not going to be able to properly discern. Like, imagine a young coach who only has access to one mentor, right? And is not a mentor that you want to be learning from, right? But then 5 years later down the line, or 6 years later down the line, he realizes, like, fuck, I've just wasted 5 years of my life or 6 years of my life. So that's why recognizing early a good mentor and somebody that you want to learn from is critical, Gary. A lot of people talk about team identity, okay? Does team identity get formed from having a vision, or are they different things? Do they come?
No, yeah, that's a good question. I think that's what it is. It's just a short answer. I think that's exactly what it is. You have to have a vision, and then in the process of trying to achieve that vision, you are forging the identity of the team.
Got it.
I think they're the same thing. Yes.
Right. Okay. So now you have your identity, you have your vision. Okay. And look at, man, we just spent the last half hour talking about how to actually come up with one. So that's not a simple thing either, but now that you have it, okay, how do you actually go about executing it and getting your players to buy in and getting every single player to be on board? Right. Because one of the things that I've struggled with early in my coaching career, and even still to this day, is yes, I have a vision. We want to possess. We want to press when we don't have the ball. But I find it difficult to get every single person on the team bought into that. And a lot of times it seems like we go away from that, right? When maybe the game gets away from us, losing 1-0 or 2-0, still a lot of time left in the game,
Gary.
And the players start launching the ball. And then at halftime, you bring them back and say, no, this is our vision. But it's like they get it, but they don't truly get it. And I think when I watch Brian's teams play, the youth teams, Chivas, Galaxy, every single player on the field knew their role. Everybody knew how Brian wanted to play, and they went out and executed it. So it sounds easy, right? Oh, yeah, I'm going to have this vision. My team's going to play possession. Everybody says they want to play possession, Gary. But how do you actually go and execute that with your players?
Well, it's challenging. Well, you need a methodology that you know works. That's already difficult, right? Because how do you know it works if you haven't done it yourself? Okay. You have to trust maybe somebody. And it goes back to what we riffed on for 10 minutes just prior to this. And then it takes time. So you need the methodology, a good methodology, a correct methodology. And then you need time. How much time depends on your capability as a coach to execute the methodology. And that's a whole other episode, Benny. And then you also need the players to have sufficient time, depending on their level and depending on the level of your opponents that you're going to be facing in competitions, to develop into the vision, develop into the identity. For example, if you are a recreational level team or a mid-level youth team, okay, at those lower levels, your competition is not very good either. So the chances that you're going to be able to deploy said methodology is actually higher when you were competing at a lower level, because your opponent doesn't have answers to what your team is doing. So in this case, maybe it'll take you 6 months. And then a year, which is a whole season with your team, obviously is going to be better than 6 months. Your players and you as a coach are going to get better and better and better at it. After 2 years, even better. After 3 years, even better. After 4 years, even better. So the less turnover you have in your roster, the better everybody's going to understand it, the better the team's going to function. However, some players don't get it, as you said, or are dragging, it's taking very long, or they're just not keeping pace with the level of the other players or the opposition. And that's when those players probably either have to be cut from the team or they themselves leave for greener pastures, more playing time, you know, somewhere else where it's a better fit. And you as the coach, as a club, bring in more technical players, more players that are more developed in the fundamentals. And it's easier maybe then to incorporate those guys and have those guys contribute to the overall identity of the team. For instance, if you get somebody that doesn't quite fit into Spain's national team or Barcelona or something that has a super hot dialed in identity, they stick out like a sore thumb, and those players don't last on Barcelona, and they get like immediately spit out, and you have to bring somebody else who does fit the Barcelona DNA, like a Sergiño Dest, you know, just to mention an American, a player that people understand because this is our audience. He went to Barcelona because he got taken to Barcelona by the Dutch coach who went and became Barcelona's coach. And obviously Sergiño Dest was also Dutch, was playing in Ajax and PSV Eindhoven, Ajax rather, and he brought him over because of that common cultural. But Sergiño Dest doesn't have the Barcelona DNA necessarily, not really. And so it just didn't work out for him. So he came in and he got spit out. It's not that he's a bad player, he just doesn't fit. So I already lost track of your original question. It's like, how long does it take or something like that?
It was in regards to how do you get the players bought into?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Execute it on the training ground and in the games. How do you execute your vision?
Yeah. Okay. We covered your coaching capability with the methodology. The better you are at the methodology, the better you're going to be able to teach your players the methodology, the better you're going to be able to identify if they're fucking up in the training exercises and how to correct them and how to motivate them and all that sort of stuff. But obviously the number one thing that gets players bought in is success on the field in competition, which is winning games. I'm sorry, it sucks, but unfortunately, it's important. If you win games deploying this, your vision, then the players are going to be like, oh, wow, yeah, this stuff works. Let's keep doing it. Let's do even more of it. And you have that narrative as a coach to say, see, guys, it works. Let's focus. Let's do even more of it and crank up the intensity and crank up the demands of the players. If you're constantly losing, then nobody's going to buy into your vision. So this is another thing about You know how here in the United States, everybody complains, oh, winning at all costs and blah, 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 that does damage and stuff. Guys, unfortunately, this is a part of human nature. You have to have success, which equates to winning, in order for you as a coach to continue deploying your vision, your methodology.
Going back to the example of the coach that I gave that didn't have a mentor growing up, right? You just said winning is what's going to produce buy-in. Imagine that coach as a young player was on a team his whole life that was direct and just hit long balls to their man child, but they won every game, Gary, and they became national champions. Now, what is that coach going to want to play like as he becomes a young coach?
Correct.
He wants to play direct. He wants to launch the ball. Why? Because it fucking works. It works.
Correct.
Right? So that's just the differentiator there. You said methodology a lot, Gary, and it may be crystal clear, obvious to a lot of people, but I don't care. I'm still going to ask you anyways. You know, how do you define a methodology and what is a methodology, Gary? Because there may be new listeners that have never heard you say the word methodology before, and maybe a parent who doesn't know what methodology is. So just a quick explanation of what that means and what it is.
Yeah, it's a really great question. I'm glad you kind of confessed that too, because it happened to me when I graduated university and got my first like professional job as an engineer. I was working at Boeing right here close to LAX doing spacecraft design and engineering. And I went to one of my first meetings, you know, and I'm surrounded by very smart people. Okay. Most have advanced degrees. Many have doctorates, scientists and engineers. And that's when I kind of first heard the word methodology used over and over and over again. I'm like, what are these people talking about? Methodology, what? And I kind of even remember, like, they had a little projector screen. They drew a little circle, right? And they wanted to find what's called the antenna gain, which is basically the amount of radiation falling within a particular region of space. And they had a little circle. And they were going through this kind of computer program to sample different points in the circle, whatever. And so they were describing the methodology and all the PowerPoint slides had methodology, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, what is going on? So that was my first exposure. I'm sorry to go off on a little rant there, but I didn't know. And so, you know, I think the best thing I can do here, I brought it up while you were asking the question. I brought it up on chat here, and it says methodology means the system of principles, methods, and processes used to accomplish something. Okay. So when we're talking about soccer.
Sorry,
yeah, go ahead.
Can you say that again? I want it to be crystal clear for the audience.
Sure, sure. It says methodology means the system of principles, methods, and processes used to accomplish something. You know, let's not deconstruct all that. I think it's kind of self-evident what we mean. But in the context of football, to fulfill your vision of maybe possessing like Spain and you know, counterattacking like Real Madrid and counter-pressing like Jurgen Klopp's Borussia Dortmund or something like this, that's your vision. Okay, now what are the methods and processes and principles that you're going to deploy in order to achieve that vision? That bunch of things is the methodology, and it is manifested in your training grounds, your training activities that you do with your players, and beyond that also. But if we stick with just the training activities, it would mean like, okay, how do we train our team on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or Tuesday and Thursday? What activities are we going to deploy? Well, we're going to deploy the 4v1 rondo. We're going to also deploy the 4v4+3. We're going to deploy a building out of the back exercise with no pressure, and then with a little bit of pressure. And then we're going to deploy the whole concept of losing your man, right? So that you dismark yourself if somebody's guarding you, right? And you can receive a pass with less pressure. These are fundamental principles, but what are the exercises that are going to train your players to do these things? Okay, we need to deploy some attacking patterns to give them some sort of idea, some sort of structure as to how to attack the opponent. So all of those things are part of the methodology. And then also part of the methodology might be, hey, what do I as a coach and my technical staff, for instance, do outside of the training ground? Like, I don't even have my players right now. Is there something that I need to be doing to fulfill my vision? Well, yeah, maybe something would be, hey, prepare your session before you go there and don't just whimsically pick some stuff out of a hat. Okay, so you need to be prepared. And then after your training session, should I be doing something to fulfill my vision? Well, yeah, maybe you're assessing the training session that just happened. What worked, what didn't work, what players were on point, what players were not on point, and reassess your evaluation of the team and of the individual players. And you create this iterative loop to then, oh, when I meet with them next session, now I adjust, right? So all of that is part of the methodology. Part of the methodology could also be, hey, how do I communicate with, if I'm talking about youth soccer here, how do I communicate with the parents? How am I inclusive? Am I not inclusive? How inclusive am I? How available do I make myself? How unavailable do I make myself? What do I tell Karen? What do I tell, John? Do I tell them the whole truth and nothing but the truth? Well, that might be detrimental to the development of the player. If I basically tell, hey, Karen, Johnny's just terrible. No, that's probably not conducive to the vision and the methodology. So what do you say instead of telling Karen your kid is terrible? That's all part of the process, right? That's all part of it. All part of it. Do I have assistant coaches? Yes or no? If I do, what kind of assistant coach should I have? What should I have my assistant coaches help me with? What should I not have my assistant coaches help me with? All of that is part of the methodology to fulfill your ultimate vision.
Yeah, look, Karen, your son has a very bright future ahead of him. Right now, he's struggling a bit, but, just trust the process and everything's going to be okay.
Yeah. No, but all of it matters. And you know this, Ben. You've been coaching for 10 plus years.
Of course. No, Gary, I mean, with all that context in mind, this might be one of the most important podcasts that we've ever recorded, because without a coach having a vision, everything else is meaningless, basically, right? Imagine a coach that doesn't have a vision, doesn't have a view of how he wants the team to play. So in the training session, what are you actually working on then? What are you actually working on, right? Oh, yeah, we're going to do shooting today. Oh, we're going to work on headers today. I would recommend to any parent joining a new team, or you're at the tryouts, ask the coach, what is your vision for the team? And if the coach comes back and says, we want to compete, we're going to work hard, fucking run, man. If the coach doesn't say anything about like the style of play or this is how I want the team to play, I would run for the hills, man.
Yeah. Well, and this is how they escape this very question, Benny. They escape it by saying, well, no, actually, what we need to do and what I want to do is develop the individual players to maximize their potential. And how am I going to do that? Well, the individual players need to learn how to pass and shoot and dribble. So here are the exercises for passing and shooting and dribbling. And I'm going to have them repeat that over and over and over again so that they get better at passing and shooting and dribbling. So that's how they escape any accountability, anything whatsoever having to do with developing the individuals within the team context, because that means a lot of fucking hard work. And that's how you also escape a lot of accountability for results on the weekends, because, hey, you're here to develop the individual the way that I just told you. So results on the weekend, that's a team thing. That doesn't matter. The individual is what matters. And on the weekend, what matters also then, according to that philosophy, is playing time. Because the more I put the player on the field, the more opportunities he has to dribble, pass, and shoot, and head the ball or and defend or what, you know what I mean? It's like, so that's why everybody should have roughly equal playing time, because I want to develop all the individual players. All escaping the sport itself. You're not developing any, you're not playing football.
Yeah, it's a sad trap that parents fall into. And there's a lot of clubs here in Southern California that operate on this way, Gary. It's all of their training sessions are individual based. And the way that they get parents in is by posting individual clips on social media of moments from the game of their players doing like a Maradona or like a double scissor and cut, and the video blows up and it's like, wow, look at how amazing this club is. They're producing ballers. They're developing players. But how come you don't ever see those clubs post a full game of their teams because it's probably shocking, man. But if you're a parent and you don't know any of this and you go online and you see an 8-year-old kid doing a rainbow, you're like, why isn't my kid doing a rainbow? I need to go to this environment. They're actually making soccer players. So it's yes. a trap that parents are falling into, man. And it's really unfortunate.
And coaches fall into the trap too, because doing this is infinitely easier than doing what we discussed prior, which is this whole having a vision and then deploying a methodology to accomplish that vision. That is real coaching. That is real work. And ultimately, that is what truly develops the individual players.
And I don't know if they're unaware or they're ignorant to it or what it is as to why they're not wanting to develop the team. But I see it a lot, man. I'm sure you've seen it too. I'm sure the audience has as well. I'm not going to call it the clubs by name, but there are a lot that exist out there that's how they try and get you in. Like I've literally seen it was like a parent meeting of the club, and it was the first day that all the parents are out there. And the coach is literally saying, we're not going to work anything team. Your son or daughter is going to be on the ball for 2 hours every single day here at the session. And if you're not okay with that, then this isn't the place for you. You know, so at least he was upfront with them in that aspect. But I don't know. I feel like maybe that coach truly believes that this is the best way to develop players. And that's why they continue to do it. I don't think it's, no, we don't want to play possession, so let's just focus on the individual. I truly think that they believe that that is the best way to develop players.
I agree as well, Benny. I think that, just to throw a number out there, greater than 90% of coaches who are doing that truly believe that that is the way.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Gary, and it's selfishly because I want to know as well, right? I'm a high school coach. So many of you know that in high school, public high school at least, you're not allowed to recruit, okay? Private, you can recruit, but that's a different story. What if, let's say my vision is I want to play possession. I want to press when we don't have the ball. But what if I don't have the players to implement that methodology, to implement that style of play? Meaning that, and again, because with high school soccer, you only see them 3 months out of the year. So it's not like you have all year to train and develop it. But what if you don't have the players? Should you stick to your guns and say, no, I'm going to keep trying to do it? Or should you try and play a different way, depending on your personnel and the players that you have?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's context dependent. Let's just riff on a couple things. But one of the things that I first thought of as you were formulating it is, what is the purpose or the goal of a high school coach? I think in general, maybe the answer to that is it's not the same as that of a club coach. Are you there to develop soccer players as a high school coach? I'm not so sure, right? Maybe if that's your goal, okay, fair enough. But I know that as a youth club coach, the objective is to develop players. So with that framing, if you're not there to develop players in the same way at the high school level, then what are you there for, right? Maybe you're there to compete, right? And if the priority is simply to compete and not really to develop, then yeah, depending on your player personnel, you're like, how can I maximize my competitive level in every game? And so if you clearly are the Getafe to, you know, you're the other high school is Barcelona, the other high school is Real Madrid, and the other high school is Atletico Madrid, and the other high school is Valencia, but you're Getafe because of your roster. Well, yeah, don't try to be Barcelona, Real Madrid, or Atletico Madrid. How do I, because that's not great for competition, and you're not going to develop your players anyway because you only have them for like 3 months, right? So maximize your competitive level. If that means, okay, I have to train this team differently, not possession, then that's what you do. That's my reaction, Ben.
Yeah. And the reason I throw out the context of high school is because in any other level, right, club soccer, even college, pros, you can basically pick and choose who you want on your team. So if mm-hmm. you as a coach have a vision and you have an identity that you want your team to play, you should have no problem, season ends, replacing the players that don't fit into your vision and bringing in the next crop that do fit into your vision. But a lot of coaches don't have that luxury of getting new players and finding new players. So that's why I'm curious as to, like, yeah, if you don't have the right personnel, you shouldn't be, like, if the personnel that I had in one of my first years of, like, the Frosch team, like the lowest level, if we were to try and possess and play like Barcelona, right, every single time building out of the back on a goal kick,
you're dead.
Goal. Yeah. You know, but again, like, even so, I still tried to stick to my, this was like my second year coaching. So I'm like, nah, fuck it. Like, I don't care. Towards the end.
But there's a trap.
Better. They got better.
But there's a trap here. And the trap is, are you as a coach truly capable of discerning the level of your roster relative to the other high school's rosters? Wow. Because I can see a huge proportion of coaches using this that we just discussed as a coping mechanism for not doing the hard work and not having possession. Because they'll be like, oh yeah, my team just sucks. My players just suck. So I'm not going to do that. When in fact, it might not be true at all. It might in fact be true that if you were a good coach and capable with this methodology, that you would be very successful as a high school team with a possession-based identity like we all like and would love. Yeah. But they're like, oh no, I don't have the players, but that's not true.
Yeah, yeah. And it's difficult because in high school, there's a lot of teams are dependent on one or two players.
Yes.
And they are just difference makers, man. Like, you know, my team could play the best possession possible, 90% versus 10%. And those two players can get on the ball twice.
Yeah.
Do damage in the game. And most teams, I know we're talking a lot about high school, but most teams in Southern California at least play very direct, meaning hitting a long ball to their nine, knock it down. I've seen very few teams that actually try and possess. And one of them is a shout out Billy at Canyon, longtime listener of 343. They possess. There's a couple other teams, but you don't see it much, man, in high school.
Yeah.
I like to think of high school as kind of like a national team environment, right? Because you only see your players a couple months out of the year, and then they go off into their own respective club teams, right? And then they come here and compete for the pride of their school and things like that. But
yeah.
Anyways, long rabbit hole there.
No. But what's also interesting, if we pull on this string, because I know a lot of high school coaches listen to us and are also in the program. Again, high school soccer isn't the highest of levels. And so since it's not at the highest of levels and your opponents aren't either, and so the chances that you're able to deploy this methodology, a possession-based methodology, is quite high. You are able to build. You could build. But yes, what you said is true, Benny. The other team might have a difference maker who just grabs the ball and just goes by two or three of your guys and scores. And that's it. And you can't blame yourself for that too hard.
Yeah. I'm getting flashbacks. We need to move on from high school.
Okay.
So obviously, we talked about getting the players bought in, and you touched on it briefly about making sure the parents are aligned with the vision as well. But how important is it to, especially the start of the season, you're taking over a new team or a new season starting, how important is it to get the parents bought into the vision of the team? Because
it's critical, man. It's critical because the parents are
what?
Well, the parents are in the ears of the players. The players are ultimately the ones who are going to perform or not perform and buy into you or not buy into you. And you have to have the parents aligned with your vision as a coach in order for when they're whispering in the ear of their child, they're whispering the same things or the proper things or the correct things that are aligned with the coach's vision. Because if they're going against the coach's vision or saying things that, undermine the coach's authority, then obviously the player is going to reflect that in their training, their games. And everybody's not aligned, and the chances of your vision becoming true or toast. And that kid's not going to develop either. So you have to have the parents bought in so that they're reinforcing the same message that you're trying to inculcate.
Were there ever instances of, whether it be a player or a parent, where maybe they're a phenomenal player, great attitude, great mentality, but they just don't fit in
yes.
the type of style of play that you want to play? And what do those conversations look like with the kid and then with the parent?
The kid, at least from my personal experience, the kid is never the issue, Ben. The kid is kind of, the kid admires you, knows that you care about them, knows that you want what's best for them. and you've communicated very well with them over the course of months or even years at times, why X is good for them, why Y is bad for them. And so they're never the issue, right? Even if you have to have a serious talk with them because something's wrong, yeah, the kid's cool. So that discussion is not a big deal. The parent discussion is very different because by the time that you have the serious talk with them, or they come to you with a serious talk, it's not necessarily something that just materialized for them. You know, it's something that has been festering inside them for a long period of time. And they've developed a particular narrative in their minds about what's going on, what's right and wrong in their minds over the course of weeks, months, maybe even years. And they come talk to you. So that discussion isn't one where you're going to bring them necessarily back into the fold. Even if, I don't know, even if you perfectly execute the delivery of your message. Now, if something hasn't been festering in their mind for that long a period of time, then they haven't really ossified a mental model in their heads and they come to you and talk to you, then you can bring them into the fold relatively easily. Because think about it this way. I guess it's a function of your expertise too, Ben, because if you've been at this for a very long time and you mastered your craft to a certain level, you've heard everything, you've thought of everything hundreds or thousands of times. So you have the answers to pretty much everything that a parent might have thought of. So you can basically explain to them their own rationale and explain to them then why that rationale has some merit, no merit, or something in between, right? And then if you master it so much, Benny, then you can bring them into the fold. So I don't know if you wanted examples. So examples, usually the biggest example is playing time. Almost always, Benny, almost always. And so, or actually that's not true. Sometimes it's not playing style. Sometimes it's where the player is being positioned.
Johnny's not a center back, Gary. What the fuck are you doing?
Correct. Correct. And no matter how much you explain it to them, that one usually you can't come back from. Because if the parent is hell-bent on their kid scoring goals, and that is not where the kid is being played, and that's not changing, then that parent is not going to change their mind. They want to see their kid score goals. And you're playing them as a center back or as an outside back or as a D mid, that's a problem. So eventually that there's going to be some churn there. That player is going to leave, either voluntarily leave or they're going to have to be cut for next season.
How long would you give a player before making that decision? Like, is it a year long trial? Is it 2 years? Like,
It depends. It depends on the player's posture. And whether the player's posture is impacting the rest of the players. And it also depends on the level of, unfortunately, and I know there's, because like I just said, I've heard it all, unfortunately, how good the player is. Because if the player is a super crack phenom and he's not fully aligned, right, and has some bad postures here or there, you give that player way more time and way more patience and have way more talks with them and the parents potentially to try to bring them into a better posture and better alignment. This is just reality.
See, but that could be a trap too, because you're giving one player grace and you're allowing them to, not allowing them to make mistakes, but you're giving them more of a pass, right? And then you can have another parent coming to you saying, well, why isn't my kid playing? He's doing everything that you ask. Michael's over there. He's not doing what you're saying, but he's still on the field. And you want to tell the parent, like, well, Michael's fucking 20 times better than your kid, but you can't say that, right? You say, oh, well, you know, Michael's working hard and your kid's going to get their opportunity, but you don't say the truth, man. You don't say the truth.
Why is my kid not being picked for, I don't know, the math Olympiads, you know what I'm saying? He does all his homework. He's been here forever. And that other kid over there, I heard him say something that's not classy and he doesn't comport himself. Yeah, but that other fucking kid is a super genius. He's going to represent the country in the math Olympiad, whether he's classy or he has no class. I don't care. He's going to the Olympiads.
But he doesn't do his homework, Gary. So it's like, oh, what the fuck? Like, he's not doing
his... Don't matter.
Like, it is... But that's the reality of life and the survival of the fittest, right?
Talent is talent, man. Results are results. And I hope nobody in the audience takes it to the extreme. Well, Gary, what if somebody is a murderer? Don't, you know what I mean? Like, don't be dumb. You know what I'm getting at. You know what we're getting at. This is just facts.
For sure, man. I feel like we've talked about that before on a different episode, but it could be a whole episode in and of itself of your best players getting more grace, man.
Yes.
You need them on the field.
Yes.
So imagine your best player who you depend on for 2 or 3 goals every game, showing up late to training or has an altercation with his teammate or something where it's like, okay, maybe this kid shouldn't play. But you as a coach know that without this kid, you're probably not going to win.
But it's not just for winning, right? If you have the best player on the field, it makes the other players around them better,
right,
at football,
right?
So having them on the field makes the other player's development better. And what we discussed earlier, yes, if you win, then that gives you a longer runway as a coach to deploy the methodology, which is good for all the other players' development.
But somewhere you have to draw the line. Right,
somewhere. So if he murders somebody, sure. Well, you tell me what's crossing the line.
I don't know. Like fucking the kid, you're giving a speech to the team, and the kid says like, "Fuck you, coach. You don't know what you're talking about."
Right.
Listen, I don't care who you are. You could be messy. You say that to myself or any of the staff. You're not playing. You
know? Yep.
I don't care if we're playing in the CIF final. I don't care if we're playing the state championship. If you cross that, but that's where you have to establish the boundaries and draw that line early in the season. Otherwise, if you just let them get away with anything, they're going to take advantage of you the entire season. Right?
Yep.
So it's, you got to draw the line early, man.
Yep. Correct.
And the best players usually seem to toe that line very, very closely, you know, because they know that they can get away with it.
Yep. Yep. So unfortunately, so much depends on the coach's experience. And the coach's competence.
Yeah.
More experienced and more competent. You've run into all these scenarios before and you know how to draw the lines, when to draw the lines. You know how to sense where a kid is mentally. You see everything, Benny.
Yeah.
You just see it. You recognize it. And you know this. When you first started coaching, you were blind as a bat. You couldn't see anything. You had no concept of what was going on.
Yeah, that's why, man, coaching is, it's filled with so many difficulties, man, because we're humans, man. You're humans. And so how can you go to, I'm going to give you 2 examples of a player, okay? Jose is the best player, but he's a fuck up off the field. And then you have, I don't know, George. He's not the best player, but he works his ass off. He's there every single day. He's respectful. He shows up on time. He helps clean up the gear. And Jose doesn't do any of that shit. Jose just does whatever the fuck he wants. But if you take all that away and you just specifically look at their functions on the field, what can they produce on the field? What can they bring to the team? Jose is 10 times better than George. So as a coach, it's very difficult to tell George, you're not playing today, or Jose's starting over you. Because what do you preach to your team at the start of every season? Playing time is earned. If you work hard, if you show up, if you are a good teammate, if you're coachable, then you're going to play. But fucking George can be putting in 12-hour shifts every day, and he's never going to catch up to Jose's level. You know, so that's why as a coach, it's hard, man. You have to make those decisions, and you got to have real conversations, man. Otherwise, everybody is going to be thinking something that's not true, right? You got to be honest, and it's very hard to be honest as a coach.
Yeah, the conflation most make when we say playing time is earned, the conflation is, well, you mentioned, well, he's earned it. He shows up on time. He does everything right, blah, blah. That is what most people immediately go to when you say earning. But for me, earning is more sporting merit. You earn it by having the sporting merit to be on the field. Are you more technical? Are you more tactical? Are you more skilled? Are you better than player B? That is earning it and getting on the field. It's not all the other stuff, working hard, showing up, being respectful. That other stuff is an ingredient, don't get me wrong, but what that earns you is opportunities to be on the field. It's not earning you more than the guy who's better at the sport than you are. Yeah, but you're right, Benny. All these are conversations that you have to have.
So we just spent the whole last hour talking about having a vision as a coach. But what about having vision in the game as a coach? Maybe that could be a whole nother episode and you just touch on it briefly, Gary, but
it's a whole other episode. I'll touch on it briefly. So yeah, put yourself in the coach's shoes. The game is happening, right? And are you capable of seeing what's actually going on in the game? Yes or no? And there's levels to this. And very simply speaking, the lowest of all levels is you as a coach are ball watching, right? So you're watching whoever has the ball. And that only gives you some vision as to what's happening with that player who has the ball currently. Did he lose it? Did he keep it? Did he have a successful dribble, unsuccessful dribble, all the superficial stuff, which most fans are at. That's the level that they're at, which most parents are at that level also. Okay. Level two is not looking at the ball carrier, looking at maybe the immediate vicinity around the ball carrier. Level three maybe is like the ball carrier is way over here in the top right corner and you're looking at your right back over here in the bottom left corner. You're not even looking at the ball anymore. And then obviously, if you have a methodology, then that guides you and a vision, right, that we discussed, that guides you as to what's going right and what's going wrong for your team in the context of a match. That's having vision, right? And then if you take yourself out of the match environment, you put yourself in the training environment as a coach, having vision is, again, being able to discern whether the exercise is going well, going mediocre, or going poorly. And in order to do that, you have to know the level of your players. In order to do that, you have to know the activity inside and out. I don't know. It's a whole other episode, Benny.
Levels, man. Levels. All right, Gary, before we interject the clip, can you give the audience a little context of what the 343 Summit is and was? Man, this comes from the first one. So maybe maybe you remember like preparing this talk or, you know, where did this idea come from of you talking about vision? Do you remember your opening speech at the summit?
Partially, this brings back memories as we're discussing it. So I think it was a brief 15-minute talk, like you said. I opened up the summit. So the summit is basically a coaching conference that we held. A lot of people had been clamoring for it. Coaches who were in the coaching program were saying, hey, Gary, you should host a conference. And because they had been to other coaching conferences, like the most famous one is the U.S. Soccer Coaching Conference once a year, whatever. And thousands of people go there and vendors, and it's a big sales job. And they're like, hey, you should host a conference. So I'm like, okay, fine. Let's go ahead and maybe do a little conference. We launched it. I don't even remember what year it was. And maybe we had about 50 coaches from across the country show up. Most of those coaches were already part of the coaching program themselves. And we invited some speakers that we knew and we thought could offer some value. And we ourselves spoke, myself and Brian, obviously. And I opened up the whole conference with this 15-minute talk. And I was just thinking, what should I talk about? And I said, you know what? The best thing to do is maybe set the stage for everybody else and set the objective. And the most important thing is having a vision. That's the most important thing. Because if there's no vision, then you're just listening to a bunch of random talks and random stuff coming out of future speakers' mouths. And you can't stitch it all together into one coherent methodology or one coherent learning exercise. So that's it.
Got it. Would you ever consider doing a summit for parents, Gary? Mm-hmm. You know, parents love going to Vegas and getting, you know, team dinners and all that type of stuff. So
yeah, I never thought about it. This is the first time you're bringing it to my attention. I mean, I've only thought about it in the sense that clubs from across the country have invited me to go speak at their club, and they would have like two things, right? It could be a coaching thing, and I would give a talk or presentation or something. And also they would bring in their parents, you know, on a separate day or separate talk. And I would be talking to the parents because they're like, oh, Gary, it'd be so valuable because all this experience that you've had, you know, from every age group and every level, and you've worked with professional soccer players for the better part of a decade. So you've seen that the ultimate objective, what ultimately happens with player development and what are the challenges after youth soccer. So you can use that also as an instrument to help parents see the end product, right? That the parents shouldn't focus solely on what's going to happen this weekend and shouldn't solely focus on what happens this entire year. They should have a 5 to 10 year outlook, right? So again, having a vision, giving that vision to the parent, and then working backward from that vision so that the parent understands kind of the stages, the real stages from a seasoned practitioner. And I've always said no thanks.
Why not?
Yeah, for a bunch of reasons, Benny. Like you start thinking about your time, you know, your energy, your effort, and do I really want to do that? Yes or no? And I've always come to the conclusion that it wasn't worth it. But I don't know, Ben. I don't know. I'll tell you the conditions under which I would do it. I don't know. Maybe if parents want something like this, they should message you. And if we get hundreds of parents that are legitimately like, yes, I will go to this thing, that would be step one. And then step two is like, okay, Benny, you have to organize it. You do the logistics and stuff. I'll help along the way, but I don't want to do all of that shit, right? I just want to show up, I'll talk, and then bounce. That's it.
It's funny because that's exactly what you say in your opening of this clip that I'm going to interject.
Okay. What do I say?
That, like, you know, you're totally open to doing the summit and you'll help, but you're not going to be the guy to fucking run the logistics of it.
Oh, really? There's a clip of me saying that?
You say that in the intro of your thing.
Are you serious? Okay, cool.
Anyway, so there's the context behind this clip that we're going to drop right here. Guys, if you're listening on audio version, I'd recommend head over to YouTube, find this episode. That way you can see what Gary looked like 12 years ago, and you're going to see how much American soccer has aged him over the last 12 years. Because
I look fresh.
You look like a kid there, bro.
Oh, do I look a lot younger?
Yeah, you look very young, man.
Holy crap, man. How long ago was that?
No, it was, you had no beard as well. So that helped.
That could help.
Yeah, that was in 2014.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Okay, good, man. Anything else?
I think, man, there's so much more, but for the sake of time, we'll hold it for the next one.
Perfect, Benny. All right.
All right, Gary. Thank you.
Later, man.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to start out really quick with a brief little story. So maybe around 6 months ago, January, February timeframe, somebody from up north in Oregon got on a plane, flew all the way down to LA, Orange County, to watch our teams play. Okay, the 14s, the 16s, and the 18s, because Portland, their academy was coming down south and they were going to compete against us. And also to link up with us. Okay, so that was one gentleman. Another gentleman who drove 5, 6, 7 hours from up north as well, made that trek down south. They both linked up. Okay, they linked up with us. I got invited to go to a restaurant with them, you know, talk a little shop. And then 5 hours of my ass seated in a booth later, the idea for this came up. Okay, the idea for this came up, and I said, fantastic. I think it's a great idea. We need to convene, get everybody on the same page, you know, get the networking rolling, you know, accelerate the educated process. And pretty much I said, fantastic, go do it. I'll put my weight behind it, but go do it. That one person who did all the work to organize and make this a reality is John Pranich. Okay, round of applause for John. Thank you, John. And the other gentleman who flew all the way down was Chris Kramer as well. So that shows some dedication, okay? And that's what it takes. Go crazy, dedicated, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So that's why we're here, okay? The network matters, and thank you guys. Okay, let's get to it. Finally, I'll stop the whole BS on from that perspective. All right, I want to talk to you guys about something that I think is problem number one. And a lot of us already fail, and a lot of us can always get a lot better at this. And that problem, that topic is vision, okay? We need to have vision. So vision, we need to have a vision, right? How we want to play, for example, and then we actually have to have vision while the games are actually happening or while we're watching games on TV or while we're on the sidelines. So we need to develop this skill, because if you don't have these things, then what the heck are you guys doing in the training sessions, right, without having some end goal in mind? Fantastic. Well, first thing, there's general vision. So a lot of people have general vision, meaning I want to play like these guys. How many coaches out there in the world say, we play possession soccer, right? I model my thing after Barcelona. I have a vision. That's not really a vision. That's very simple. That's very general. Or let's go a little further. I want to play like Barca, right? I want to counterattack like Real Madrid, and I want to press like Chile. Is that a vision? Maybe a starting point to a vision. Okay, you have some sort of nebulous concept in your brain, but you have to break that thing down further. This general vision isn't good enough. General vision is for spectators. Go to a stadium, here I am with Hans. Hopefully you guys chatted a little bit last night. And what happens here is 95,000 people are watching the person with the ball and completely ignoring everybody else, all the other 20 players on the field. So we need to focus on things that aren't exclusively on the ball. I'm going to show you and start off with a really quick video here. So what did we see, right? Do we have vision? Do we understand what's going on? If we have somebody, a non-coach, sit here, right? Maybe a parent. I know you guys, a lot of you guys are parents, right? But you guys have also had a lot of experience with parents, and they think they have vision, right? They're watching this stuff, and what is it that they're going to report? Yeah, the red team had possession, they had all the ball, right? The white team didn't have much, and the white team just kicked it out at the end. Is that vision? That's not vision, as you guys all know, right? We can dive a lot deeper. We have to dive a lot deeper to understand what actually went down here, and if it was orchestrated, or if it was all just a big accident, right, that the red team had the ball. So let's go further, beyond general vision, okay? So we need to explore how Barcelona keeps the ball, how Real Madrid counterattacks, how Chile actually presses. We need to zoom in and look at the structures that are being employed there. So instead of ball watching, right, you're looking at all the players on the field. Here's some structures for you, right? We want to possess and we want to press. That's how I want our teams to play. I imagine that's how you guys want your teams to play. So we need to look at the structures that build up possession and pressure. So the first structure, right, are these rondos, these numbers up games. So three players in possession, four players in possession, depending which one you're looking at, and one defender. You set this thing up, you know, 7-8 yards apart, and you have a little possession-based game, and the defender in the middle pressing. So that's a structure. Fantastic. It develops a lot of fundamental skills, right? A lot of fast thinking. Brian is going to dive a lot deeper into this actual exercise. Another structure, building out of the back, okay? Very simple. Here's our keeper, center back, outside back, and there's our holding mid. You see this structure there, and we're going to revisit it, right, in our clips. Here's another structure, losing your man, right? You need to make some space for yourself when you're going to receive the ball. We train this. And attacking patterns. It's not just some individual saying, oh, I get the ball, what am I going to do with it? I guess I'll dribble, I guess I'll pass here, I guess I'll go backwards. All of this stuff needs to be trained on the pitch and then attempted to execute it on the field. So here's, right, one example. Here's our outside back, center back, center back. Outside back gets the ball. He's going to feed our winger. When he feeds the winger, he makes an overlapping run. Winger gives him the ball back. And obviously, these are a little bit more complicated that we'll dive into a little bit deeper. But these are all patterns of play that we train, and then you have to attempt to execute on the field. And pressing. We just don't say pressure the ball, right? We have to, on the training pitch, once again, instruct every single player precisely how we're going to press in unison as one block. So there's some structures, right, that lead us to ultimately having a vision of play. So I'm going to run this clip now, and you notice I put this particular structure down here, and then we're going to see it in the real world. Right, keeper gets the ball, and we have those back five perfectly situated. Okay, one more time, it's on a loop here. Keeper gets the ball, right, outside back, spread to the outside of the 18, or these are the outside backs, these are my center backs, play to the center back. How do these guys react? That's all choreographed. This association here is a structure. This association here is a structure. It's no accident, okay? We train the players. One last time, because I'm going to point another structure on losing your man. Dish it out. Let's pay attention to this guy. He looks upfield, and our winger is already losing his man, trying to make this pattern. That's vision, right? So once you're actually witnessing a game or witnessing your team on the sidelines, are we executing our vision or not? We want to possess and we want to press. What are the structures to accomplish that vision? Now, actually having vision. If you're not coaching, you're at the game, what are we watching? Do we want to watch just the ball? Obviously not. You guys know all of this stuff. As the center backs have the ball, what's this guy doing? Backpedaling, making open space. Backpedaling, making open space. How does Barca's structure, what is Barca's structure? We have to deconstruct it, okay? And once you deconstruct it, then maybe you can take it back to your home field, your own team, and say, okay, I saw this structure that Barca executed. I'm going to try and choreograph that into my team as well. Make sense? Same thing with Real Madrid counterattacking. It's not an accident. It's not some long ball and then it's an avalanche, right? The whole avalanche, the whole tidal wave of the counterattack is choreographed based on specific triggers that happen in the game. That stuff is rehearsed on the field, on the training grounds, right? Same thing with Chile. Easier said than done, right? When you're watching this, come from your own home or in the stadium, and then when you're on the sidelines with all the emotions running high, the whole chaos, parents yapping away, screaming, the kids complaining, whatever, you get scored on, the ref makes a bad call, do you have vision on the sidelines to actually communicate with your players properly and give them meaningful instruction while the game's going on? And then maybe at halftime, what do you tell your players at halftime? Do you just make stuff up and BS them? Do you think on the fly, oh, shit, okay, what am I going to tell these guys? Work hard, we're doing good, you know, we just need one goal to get back into this game. Not very meaningful. But if you have the structures in place that you rehearsed during training, you can say, hey, listen, Bobby, you're the left back. What are your responsibilities when our center back or our keeper has it? You're not doing it. You're supposed to be backpedaling to the sideline, right, to make space for yourself, to expand and make room, create space. You're not doing it. We need to see it in the second half. Make sense? So all of that is dictated by how much vision you guys actually have while the game is actually happening, right? So we have to develop that. We have to get better and better and better. And it's hard when you just have one person, two sets of eyes. If you have an assistant coach, even better. If you have two assistants, even better. If you take notes on the sidelines, that's something I recommend doing while the game is actually happening. Don't get as emotionally attached. Start making notes, right? Hey, our center forward is just standing there. He's not going into our attacking pattern when our outside back gets the ball. Make sense? Then you go into halftime, you actually have something meaningful to talk about. All of it's dictated having vision. So again, if let's say we're coaching over here, our left back has the ball, you have rehearsed. How are these guys supposed to be behaving when he has it? And then if you're on the sideline, you say, hey, Bobby, where should you be if the right back has the ball? Oh, I should be pinched in. And you start communicating to the players that are off the ball, right, instead of ball watching. All make sense? So vision, number one, the foundation to everything. If you don't have a vision, you're screwed. What the heck are you doing on the training grounds? And if you don't have vision, then you can't communicate with your players properly. Cool? Make sense? Beautiful. Starts and ends with vision. Okay. Once you have this, then we can build, and then what Brian's going to present is going to make a lot more sense. Yeah? That's what I had for you guys today. I didn't want to take up too much time. I wanted to hand it off to the day-to-day practitioners, the guy who are on the ground level, on the daily grind, yes, training day in and day out, so they can zoom into more of the details of what I just showed you.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers, everyone, and keep building.